thank you for coming back on time, everybody who's here. No, I don't know yet. Next meeting is September 23rd. We're going to have DCF testify, that's Department of Children and Families, and the Donaldson Institute, thanks to Oriana, and the Coalition for Children, Youth, and Families, so we can ask questions specific to her area of expertise at that meeting. And I wanted to let you know that Ann and Margit are going to be preparing a memo listing options, so they're going to put together an options paper for potentials for legislation. And if you have ideas for potential legislative issues that can solve some of the things we're coming up with here, please get them. Try to be as specific as possible. And I know we're trying to create a funnel here with a specific purpose, and it seems like sometimes it may be an hourglass because we're getting more information. But I just want to remind members, try to stick to questions that are toward our presenters. And if you have ideas for option papers that are kind of outside of the gamut of what we're doing, submit those, because we will have discussion among this committee without presenters, and then we can have debates as to what should be included. So having said that, I'm excited because our presenters are here. Venetia Banks from Child and Family Training, she's a consultant with them, and Diane Thompson, who is a program coordinator. Thanks, ladies, very much for coming. And we'll give you the floor. Okay. And I'll ask real quick that the roll be continued from earlier today. All right. Hi.
Hi. My name is Diane Thompson, as you said, and this is Venetia. We both work for a program called Wraparound Milwaukee out of Milwaukee Behavioral Health. And I have worked there probably for about 24 years. So I have been around through the development of our program. And Venetia is one of our program consultants. That means she helps out in difficult situations with some of our kids and families. And she can also speak from the perspective of a foster parent and an adoptive parent as well. So what I thought I would talk to you and share a little bit about, first of all, what Wraparound does, and then some of the trends we've been seeing that are concerning to us. Wraparound Milwaukee is a process in which we address mental health needs of children. As much as possible, we try to do that in the community. We're also a Medicaid HMO for mental health services for children. So many of you may be familiar with us. We've been around for about 15 years now, maybe a little longer. We have a court order program in which children are ordered into our program on a child welfare order or a delinquency type of court order. And then we have a REACH program, which is voluntary. Parents call in and ask for assistance. All of the children that come into our program have to be at risk of out-of-home placement. They have to have a history of significant mental health needs and of other services being tried at some point. And they also have some difficulty functioning in different systems areas. So it may be school, it may be mental health, maybe juvenile justice. So those are the kids that come to us. And the data that I'm going to give you today comes from our court ordered program. Altogether, we're currently serving about 1,100 children. Of those 1,100, approximately at any given time, 620 to 650 are in the court ordered part of our program. So when a child is court ordered into our program, they come into our mental health HMO, and we're responsible for providing all of their mental health services, which run the gamut from anything as simple as mentoring, to parent assistance, to job coaching, to out-of-home placements, which include foster care, group home, residential, and independent living. So we provide those services to these children and families in an effort to meet their mental health needs. Our process is based on family voice and ownership, looking at strengths, looking at what they need to achieve what they wish for their families' lives, and then providing supports and services so that they can meet those needs. And generally, our kids in the corridor portion are with us for a year. Our average length of stay is about 14 months. So with some children we have for longer than a year that we work with. Some children we are doing so well that we may get off that order before the end of the year. So we work within two systems for the court order program. I always say they're like two parallel train tracks that don't intersect. We have the Medicaid portion of our program, and then we have the court order portion of our program. And it's our job to kind of meld those two systems so they work effectively for kids and families. Renisha, did you want to add anything?
I think about the program you kind of covered.
Okay. So that's our program. So over the years, we've been noticing trends. And one of the things I've noticed in the last year, in my job as a program coordinator, part of what I did for many years were all of the children being enrolled into our program and children coming out. Now I'm a clinical coordinator, which means I troubleshoot, I deal with difficult situations. People call if there's a complaint or a concern or a question. Some of our issues are that kids may get stuck in out-of-home placement for too long, so we look at ways to support the family to try and bring them home. So in my position as a clinical coordinator, I've noticed in the last few years, actually, that we've had what we would call failed adoptions. Now, when we did some more formal meetings with people from the state, we were told that literally there were two failed adoptions for the entire year. What we see is what we call failed adoptions are parents or homes who have adopted children who, by the time they come to our program, say that child can never return to their home. So when I looked at our children, and there may be a few more, give or take. Right now, we currently have 32 youth with what we would consider to be failed adoptions, where the adoptive parent, and I hate to distinguish because their parents the same as anyone else, but I'll do that for the sake of today, who will say that child can never come home, and we're not going to be involved in any treatment you have going on. So those are parents who may not necessarily have the financial means or the ability to go back into court and have those adoptions terminated, but in our eyes, they're kids who may get stuck in out-of-home placement. And for whatever reason, I mean, and Vernicia will speak to some of the reasons an adoptive parent might get to that point, we're unable to provide them with supports that they may need because they're done at that point in time. So just a little data. I just real briefly looked at these 32 children in what would be called failed adoptions. They range in age from 9 to 19. Most of them fall within the 15 to 16 year old age range. Our population in RAP is rather fluid. We have new children being enrolled every day. We have children leaving the program. So their time in RAP has ranged from a month with one of the newer children I looked at to 6 years. Of those, 17 of those children were in child welfare orders. They came to us with those. Two of them are on straight delinquency orders, which means they were adjudicated of some type of crime. Nine of them are on dual orders, which means there's both a child welfare order and a juvenile probation order for delinquency. And four of them are on GIPS orders, which GIPS orders technically kind of fall in the middle. They may be that the child couldn't be found competent of a crime. It may be that they're chronic truants. I always call GIPS orders, they're not quite delinquency court orders. So there are four children on GIPS orders.
What is GIPS?
Juvenile in Need of Protective Services. Oh. So it's kind of an in-between, a CHIPS and a probation order. So then I looked at placements. for these young people. 12 of them are in group home placements. 6 of them are in foster homes, and of the 6 in foster homes, they tended to be the kids who were younger. So not 15, maybe not quite to adolescence yet. 2 of them are in independent living programs because they're older. 6 are in residential. 3 are in detention pending new charges. And 2 are with biological parents who are being licensed as foster homes because that's where those children want to be and their parents want them back, their bio parents. 1 is with an adult sister.
Because they're not their parents anymore.
So,
TPR them?
This is just Milwaukee County.
This is only who's in RAP, right?
Pardon?
This is only Milwaukee and only who's in RAP.
Just in our program, right. So for child welfare, there may be a bigger population. I can only speak to our program. And this is just a sample. I pulled other diagnoses and just did a quick overview because, you know, it's kind of the chicken and the egg, which came first, mental health issues, or did the mental health issues arise because of multiple placements and what has happened to these kids and the trauma they've endured. Generally, their diagnoses are no different than the rest of the population in RAP. ADHD, anxiety disorder, conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, depressive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar mood disorder, cannabis abuse, enuresis, sexual abuse and neglect, physical abuse, learning disorder. I only found 2 kids who were diagnosed with attachment disorder. 1 OCD, 1 with fetal alcohol, 3 with mild MR, and 2 with a psychotic disorder, which is pretty significant in young kids. But again, that is really no different than the norm of the rest of the population we see in the wraparound. Then we had a subset of young people that I pulled, which were kids that have been recently discharged from our program with what were considered to be failed adoptions. Again, adoptive parents who were at the point of saying these children cannot return home. And of those 11, 8 were sent to correctional placements, which, again, the orders, they may have come to us on a CHIPS order, acted out, picked up a delinquency order, and then got sent to corrections for some reason. 1 is with a new guardian who was an extended family, biological family member. 1 is in a long-term foster home, and 1 is back with a biological family. So those are young people who've been disenrolled within the last 6 months. So that's just some data to give you an idea of some of the patterns we were seeing. Vernicia, did you want to talk a little bit?
Just related to the data, because of my role, like I'm actually out with the child and family teams of these children, and usually I'm called in when they're stuck in placement, out of home placement, whether that's residential, group care, or institutionalized on a number of different occasions. And I think in the data that Diane represents is that, you know, that's kind of like the here and now. I've done this work for probably about 14 years, and within the last 2 to 4 years, I think we started with a list of 72 children. And the reason this kind of caught my eye is because I'm oftentimes in a position of trying to figure out, okay, we've tried every placement possible, where else can this child go? And many times it's back to the biological family because that's the only network that's willing to even consider it. So I think that that's worth saying because I think even though the numbers may appear small in comparison, over the years, the number of kids that are affected by this, to me, is pretty substantial. And I, as we talk about some of the themes, you know, one of the things, and part of it is because of what I do in my personal life as an adoptive parent and as a foster parent, and hearing the stories of, I also train foster parents and adoptive parents, hearing the stories of people who are coming to the table to be adoptive and foster resources is somewhat alarming when they feel like when a kid presents a certain issue, even if they've adopted them at birth, you know, to 3 years old, a kid gets to be an adolescent, well, they can give them back. And these are things that are being told to me as kind of a confidant, you know, but they're still coming from parents that you would think once they're yours, they're yours. And it's really disturbing because now I also see the kid side of that. I hear the kids telling us, you know, that they kind of just gave us back or gave us away. And that's the part of this that I want to be heard. And while I've been subpoenaed in several instances to court, really advocating that we try to do something toward parents who decide to give kids back. And I was told, well, the numbers aren't substantial enough, you know. And for me, any child who experiences that, not to mention you leave a family one time and you go to what's deemed to be your family forever and they can give you back, I don't care if it's two kids, it's too many. So that's kind of the platform that I'll talk about in terms of the themes and hopefully some resolution as we move forward.
The question that I have right off the bat is, you know, why is failed adoption a growing trend? Why are more adoptions failing? Why are more parents giving children back now? Or are we just recognizing it now?
I think it's twofold. I think that we're paying more attention to it because these are the kids now who are costing us a lot of money because they need to go into institutions or they need long-term care. The other thing is I think in children's court, and this is a generalization, but I think we've created a system where we accept a parent can say, I can't, won't, choose not to parent my child because they're difficult, and we allow that child to go to a foster home or group home or residential as opposed to having some accountability for that parent. That's whether it's biological or adoptive, but I think there's almost people feel entitled, well, I took this kid in and I can't do anything with them, so they're yours again, you know. And I think our system, I see our judges not imposing, we have kids who have been out of the home for years and the parents still get adoption subsidies. I see the judges, when a parent comes in and says, you know, I'm not going to take this kid back, okay, there's no child support that's asked for or, you know, or fought to for them to pay. And it's kind of you can easily give your kids back to the system. And we're setting that trend and we're starting to see it more and more.
How do we change it?
Well, there's many things we can do. What I was going to say is I've seen a shift to a fix the child mentality. And I always say we don't fix children, we support them through their challenges, which means they have to have a support network. But I see that the child has a problem. They're acting up, they're adolescents. There's zero tolerance for that. They have to go somewhere. They have to be fixed, which, you know, it's not something that can be done. It's a process. So what were you going to say?
Well, I was just, I wish I had the answers on how to fix. I have some things that I think will work and some of the things that we're trying to do. Part of it, I think, is we need to make our expectations for foster and adoptive parents a little bit higher. When we come into this work as foster and adoptive parents, I think that there's a certain skill set that we should be required to have, or at least to receive training in, for kids that we know come from traumatic situations. I mean, I think we'd be naive to think that you get a child at 4 and 5 or 6 who has gone through all of this trauma as a little one, and when they become an adolescent, they're not gonna have any issues. And if you go into it as an adoptive or foster parent thinking, I'm gonna love this kid to death and I'm gonna make it all better, I think that's not true. These kids are gonna come with issues. So I think that's one thing. We have to set our standards a little bit higher. I also think that for kids who know their biological families and have lived with those families, when we terminate rights, we not only terminate rights of the parent, but we're terminating the rights from every single family member. And a kid's desire, I mean, research shows us, these kids who don't even know their biological parents have questions. Kids who have been a part of those families definitely are going to have questions and oftentimes migrate back to those families. So what are we doing as a system to make sure that when we do adoptions, when kids have already established relationships with biological families, what do we do to make sure that those connections can still be kept in some capacity? It's one thing to say that as an adoptive parent, I have a right to say whether my child has contact with biological parents, and I get that. I've adopted two. I adopted one child who came to me at 2 days and one who came out of our program after 27 placements at 15 years old. So, but as an adoptive parent, it can't just be my right to say I don't want contact. When that child gets older, they should have a right to determine whether or not they want contact. And I think we're too quick to sever those ties. There's nothing done until that child's placement fails to look for those biological family or keep that connection in some capacity. And I think that's part of where we're falling down and what I would like to see change.
And our kids, even if they don't know that biological family, they hit adolescence and they find them. You know, social media is very accessible and they find those biological families. And many of our young adults or teenagers run. Then they become chronic runners and they're on the run. And then we, you know, issue a CAPIUS and have them picked up and put in detention, which they hate. And they're not criminals, they've been running to family. My thing is, if they're going to be doing that, is there a way we can involve that family to keep an eye on what's going on there, to make sure they are safe? Right now, it's their rights are terminated, no one can have any contact with them, but that's where they are. You know, sometimes for months, they're with biological family, and we're looking for them and don't necessarily know where they are, and we want to determine safety. And if they're 17, you know, we also have young adolescents who tell us all the time, who've been in out-of-home placement for quite a while, when I turn 18, I'm going back to my biological family. So is there a way we can do something around that to draw those folks in, to see if they have the skills, to see if it is a safe place for those kids to be, if that's where they're going to go, and they have an adoptive family saying, you're not coming back to my house. I'm sorry.
Jacqueline, go ahead.
The 37 statistics of kids who are in failed adoption, mm-hmm. Do you have the origin of their adoption? So were they all on the child welfare system? Were they domestic infants, international? Do you know any of that?
The majority, I would say, I can't. Maybe I recall one who was an out of country mm-hmm. adoption. The rest were all through Milwaukee okay. County.
The other thing that, well, the last thing that I have made note of is just this idea over since Adoption Safe Families Act and this push to create permanency for kids, I really think that there is almost a rush to permanency instead of figuring out what supports are these families going to need, what supports are these kids going to need. If someone says, I'm willing to adopt, we're very quick to terminate the rights and move this family, this child into permanency without taking into consideration that this is a kid who's experienced 6 years of trauma, you know, and these are the supports. And again, I've adopted, and they'll say to me, well, you can always, you know, once you adopt, you can always relook at when a child gets older, what other supports you may need or, you know, other help that you may need for this child. But it's easier said than done on all of, whether it's medical things that come up, definitely mental health stuff. It's very hard post-adoption to access real services for kids without having to go back into a system, which, you know, a lot of parents don't necessarily want to do. So I think, you know, if we slow down a little bit, I get permanency, I get the whole, you know, 15 months, and I'm for that. But I think in certain situations, and I can use a personal example of a kid that came to me as a child who, they told me, the worker said, this child, he was 6 years old, he needs an adoptive home. Are you willing to possibly adopt if that becomes the route that we go? I said, sure. After digging, I found out that not only did he have two younger siblings at home that mom was doing fine with, but that it was more of his behavior that needed help in helping mom to parent that, then this was a TPR situation. But because he had been out of the home so long, they wanted permanency, and if I would have signed on a dotted line on that day to do it, I would have got him. I worked with his mom, worked with him, got her the services. Sergio went home. And is home today after 2 years, you know, with his little sisters. And this wasn't a parent that was not, you know, was abusing or neglecting. She just had trouble with his behaviors. And I think if I would have been any other parent who was really looking to adopt, I would have had Sergio as my own. And I can tell you, Sergio at 6 and Sergio at 16 was going to have some problems being separated from his family. And he was probably going to be one of our statistics. You know, so those are the kinds of things that scare me when we kind of get locked into, we want permanency quickly, but we ignore everything else that we need to do in order to make sure it's true permanence.
And one of the things we were talking about was bonding assessments and maybe utilizing those more frequently or more appropriately to determine if someone is going to look at adopting a child, who are they bonded with, and what is that going to mean to disrupt that bond, and have any supportive services been offered to that parent if that's who they have the bond with?
And what recommendations can be made to help, even if the child does go to adoption, what are the recommendations to make sure that this is healthy and that that child maintains some type of connection, whatever's appropriate and healthy for that child?
Okay.
Another trend we've seen are kids who are placed with very elderly parents who then become infirm. We've had several children who've witnessed the death of those elderly parents, or those elderly parents have had to go into nursing homes, and then those adoptive families may have adult biological children of their own, but they don't see that child as their sibling, so there's no one then at that point who can care for that child, and that's another significant trauma for that child to go through then at that point in time. So that's another theme we've seen. And sometimes we have, while there are many, many, and again, I don't want to talk, want you to in any way think we're saying all adoptive parents are bad. There are many adoptive parents. The ones we're talking about today are the ones who are at the point where they feel they can't address their child's needs anymore. There are also adoptive parents who have significant mental health issues or their own alcohol and drug issues. And part of, I think, what Vernicia is saying, if we slow down that process and maybe looked at some of that before we place kids there, because some of those parents have, the reason the kids are acting out are due to the struggles at home as well. And it's very hard for us as a mental health provider for the children to have some of those parents accept support in those areas. So we offer it, but it's not always taken. And some of those children then end up being abused and neglected as well in those adoptive homes.
Senator?
Thank you. I just want to say, appreciate you guys' presentation today, because a lot of points that you raised are questions that are problems I have with terminating parental rights. So I'm glad that we have heard a different perspective this during our long day meeting today. and seeing, and hearing, that not all of the parents who are losing their kids to the foster care system should be permanently removed from their children, and children should be permanently the parents. So I really appreciate that perspective, and I'm glad that you reported on that today. Thank you.
Representative Tittle.
You said you have one that you adopted that had 27?
One child that I adopted, she came to my home at 2 days, so she's been with me, she's 14, and then one that I adopted at 15,
okay.
And he was actually from our wraparound program and had 27 different placements prior to my home.
Okay, and what did you do different, I guess, that obviously 27 other things didn't work?
I hung in there. The truth is, he was actually he was on my caseload, so to speak, and I put him in a home prior to coming to me and got a call 2 weeks later to come get him and just felt like that was enough and decided to take him in. And I went through ups and downs and hurdles and everything else, but I stuck in there, and that's what made the difference for him.
But you also have experience as a mental health provider, and a lot of
and
you're
where to go to
get
help and get that support, which not all parents do, unfortunately.
You say, why this? I think it's just the people that don't have a commitment. They don't have a commitment level. I mean, my I have kids 31 and 30 right now, and Boy, I remember 15 and 16. I had one rewind to that, never again. That wasn't a fun time, but, you know, and my son is adopted, but I guess I never thought of bagging it. I never thought of, you know, I guess I can't understand that mentality is that, you know, I made a commitment when he was 8 and that was it.
And I can't help but wonder if perhaps some of these families would have hung in there if they had gotten some help earlier in the process, because by the time they get to us, the issues are significant.
Yeah, we were just talking about that issue with the previous presenters today. So we are going to try to see if there are ways to change that or foster, no pun intended, that
right.
part of it. Oriana?
That was my question, Diane, is you thought like reach or something, I mean, I know we've talked as agency, some way we can get folks connected earlier, more often than a lot of folks, even before you got to stay, that's what we keep hearing over, because I really do appreciate, I was in the meeting with you when we talked about 2, and even the 35 just in Milwaukee, and I keep thinking of the type of placement and the price tag when we talk about money next to those. Not to mention how terrible that is for a child. We just talked about dollars. But if reach, if there would be some other things. I also, to Renisha, to your point, we put things forward before on post-placement, post-adoption contact, and it goes, we get a lot of serious pushback from adoptive family groups. That we believe at least as siblings should have some level of being able to make that connection. Because you've adopted, if you could just speak a little bit where that concern would lie in for people having that contact.
Where the concern would lie from the adoptive
parent?
I mean, I really can't, because I see some cons, but I see more pros. I mean, my daughter, who came to me at 2 days old, never knew her biological family. I've always had, an open type of adoption situation. Her mom chose not to reach back, but I've always supported the fact that kids should have a right to reach back to their family. And I think as parents, we have an obligation. Part of me feels like it's selfish to say, you know, I don't want my child to know who their family is, bad or good. You know, and at the end of the day, these kids become adults, and they have a right to know those things, whether I, as her mother, feels comfortable with that or not. So I can't speak to that because I don't really support that mentality. When I do the foster parent and adoptive training, I tell them all the time that this is not just you adopting or fostering a child. You got to think of that child's perspective. If you were that child, wouldn't you want to know mom and dad? I don't care who they were or what they did. So,
and something that's interesting, that was interesting to me, that Diane brought up, in the cases where you have a child who is separate from the biological family but has siblings with the biological family, I mean, they're obviously going to grow up with the question, why was I the pea kicked out of the pod? So there's probably going to be an innate yearning to get back to that family and make things right. And, you know, are there many cases where that happens and then that person is permanently adopted by someone else or put in foster care with some other family?
Yes.
And then they're expected not to have a cross-reference back to their original biological family where they have blood brothers and sisters? I think that's...
It happens.
Because it's all on the shoulders of the adoptive family. If they choose not to have that until 18, that child cannot.
And I guess one of the other questions I have is, what are some of the reasons for terminating parental rights of one of your children but not others?
The reasons that I have seen have really been because they're looking for permanent, that child has been in care too long, they're young enough where they're still adoptable, even if the other kids are back at home, if mom can't manage or dad can't manage behaviors, they want permanency quickly.
So it's usually a younger child that this
That's
happens.
Been my experience.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got on.
Yeah, of course you can.
Because I actually, you just spoke my life, actually. Because I was raised separate from all of my siblings, but had another sibling who has spina bifida, who was raised in the foster care system. And she went in pretty young. And but we did not have, we were not reconnected with her again until she was about 16, 17, when she was back to take home. And and at that point, my grandmother was her, her guardian and foster care parent. So there are various different reasons. In her case, she had, you know, physical issue. And in my case, I was just the oldest, and my mother was young, and she had me. Mm-hmm. And so my grandmother just became my parent. So there are various reasons why sibling groups are poor or what.
We've had sibling groups where both siblings have been in a pre-adoptive home, and the adoptive parent will say, we're going to take one, but not the other.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
That other sibling gets moved somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. Very. Oh, Mary, go ahead. Did you have a question?
I was just wondering, what is the age limit for the oldest that person can adopt? Being you had mentioned there are older ones that end up in nursing homes.
I don't know that because we're not child welfare. I'm not sure if they're. We've had adoptive parents in their 80s.
Wow.
And one other thing I did want to speak to is I think we have to make it easier for adoptive parents to ask for help. Mm-hmm. Part of it is still there's a stigma around getting help for kids under your care, which doesn't necessarily have to be a reflection on you as an adoptive parent, but there's still a lot of stigma. And I hear there's one family I'm really highly recommending that, you know, we have some supportive services that can look at permanency and trauma around this little 9-year-old girl they're considering adopting because her trauma in her early life was so significant. I can look at that and see that in several years there's going to be some significant behavior issues. However, this adoptive family is like, you know, we've raised 5 kids, we don't need this. Like, but this child is coming with a different set of needs, but there's still a lot of shame around just even accessing those services, which are meant to be supportive at best.
Jill.
Listening to what you're saying, like, and then it was so incredibly insightful of you to look at this little boy and see the bigger picture, which was what a good mother would do. So, but, you know, we've been talking a little bit about situations where it isn't in the best interest of the kid. So, I mean, that's the system seems to be kind of one or the other. It doesn't seem to allow for the flexibility to kind of make those determinations and that rush to place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can you, I'm not real clear on the termination of parental rights, but can parental rights be terminated without a placement set up for the kid? And then what is that, you know, so that there's, that still leaves the kid in a bit of limbo, but it gives the adoptive family and the foster families a little more breathing room.
They, in theory, they shouldn't be because that makes the child now an orphan with no family, and now they're kind of a ward of the state. We see that happen.
Essentially, aren't they already gone?
Well, yeah, right. But my thinking is, what if we know that parents are not fit? At that moment, you know, again, none of us can determine how things are going to be 5 or 6 years down the line. If we know that parents are not fit at that moment and there's some question as to whether or not this placement is going to be an adoptive resource, what's the rush to terminate rights?
Yeah.
Because the child is not back in the home.
Right.
You know, so in some situations, they don't even have contact. But why are we so quick to terminate those rights where it is very final? Before we can figure out what supports this child is going to need to work through everything they're going through and what this kid is going to look like in a couple years, you know. And again, that's not every scenario, but
right. The
things that I'm involved in, that's where I worry because I think it's either terminate or not, and I don't know that it has to be that. We have kids linger in the system for various reasons. Mm-hmm. If it's a matter of whether or not we can get this family to a place where they can at least have a relationship, maybe not even have that kid back, but a relationship.
Right.
Because that's what's going to be more healthy for the child. Why not take that time to make that decision?
Is it, in your opinion, too easy to terminate parental rights?
I feel it is. I have a lot of people that would argue, but I see it.
And you can fast track them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because what it seems to me is a parent gets fed up or frustrated, and then all of a sudden, boom, I'm done. and they want to terminate parental rights before they go through a process of, let's see, I mean, it's, in this case, it's very similar to a divorce, you know? Let's work on seeing if we can make the make it work before we end it all. So I guess before we wrap you up and let you guys go, I would like to know what are your opinions as to how we could possibly change it or make this situation so that there are less cases of fast termination of parental rights. And I mean, because some of the things you brought up to me just frankly blow my mind, and I started a little naive, but the splitting up of sibling groups and stuff like that just blows my mind. So what improvements can be made?
Well, I think bonding assessments, a look at adoptive parents' capacity, because, well, again, there are many very good, competent adoptive parents out there. There are parents who clearly have such significant needs that they should not have adopted kids at that point because their needs are so significant internally. So some type of a parenting capacity, slow down the process and really look at what's going on with the bio families. Now, there are going to be exceptions to this. There are, of course, parents who are horribly sexually abused or physically abused their children who should not have those kids back and should not have contact. But what about the extended family? I don't think we do a good enough job at looking at extended family members. Over the years, I've seen children who have had such significant acting out behaviors. And we've tried medication, we've tried residential therapy for 7 years. And the minute that they are placed with a family member, all the behaviors cease. Now, again, that's not always the situation, but that need for family is so strong. So are there extended family members? And that goes beyond just having a child welfare worker go down a list and call people and say, do you want this child? Because, you know, their response is going to be no. There has to be some more in-depth, I think, examination looking at that. We also see parents, biological parents, who are, court conditions are set for them. And Vernicia can speak to this as well. They meet every single condition. Then there's a court hearing. Oops, you have to do more. You have to do this. Well, we've met all these conditions. We've done family counseling. We've taken the child to their psychiatry appointments, their medical, dental. We've participated in family therapy. And now you're telling me I have to do yet another thing. I think some clarity around some of those conditions sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And just, I mean, once they've met it and things are safe from the reason that they were detained, let's work on getting kids back home, as opposed to saying, well, now, you know, you're struggling financially, so we're going to keep the kid out a little bit longer. Those are the kinds of things that they keep adding conditions. The other thing that I would like to see, honestly, is to have adoptive parents be held a little bit more accountable, that when you adopt a child, it shouldn't be you can go into a court and say, I don't want to parent this kid anymore, or this kid needs to have residential, or this kid needs group home placement. I mean, this is something we signed up for, you know, so why do we get to back away so easily?
It's a sticky wicket, because you don't want to make it burdensome for people to adopt either, overly burdensome.
Sure, but I would honestly, and I think that if I had the line of the 72 kids that I've worked with, I think they would rather do it before than be given back to a system, you know. So, and right now, to my knowledge, there is not, anybody can give their kid back, if they get too hard to parent.
That's crazy. Mary?
And one more.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could I add one more?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would like to see support available to adoptive parents so that when they are adopting kids who had significant trauma or abuse and neglect in their early lives, that the support is there at an earlier time before they get to adolescence, because it's coming. It's coming on the horizon. We know it's going to be there with those kids who have all that trauma. So it's okay, it's acceptable, and this is what's available to you to help with this.
Mary?
I just, as I'm speaking, I know that Milwaukee County tends to be quite a bit different than a lot of other counties in Wisconsin. I've dealt with several different families that have overturned, or dissolved, or disrupted, and it takes forever TPR, and they give every, the birth parents every available opportunity and mentoring and resources, and it's very difficult to finally get down to that final TPR. And in your case, I think that in Milwaukee County, it's a little bit different than other counties in Wisconsin where you have to actually have an adoptive resource in place in order to TPR, so it can drag out for quite a long time if that's not the case. In other counties in Wisconsin, you can TPR without any adoptive resource, and then they look for those options or try to do a concurrent plan.
And what happens is they may have an adoptive resource, but the TPR goes through, and then the adoptive resource is lost.
Potentially.
So that's where you get those kids that languish in between.
Jill?
Do you see, we were talking about it over lunch too, about the ability to avoid the system by moving? So if you're not in Milwaukee County and you move to another county or another state, how much of this information actually follows the parents, follows the kids? Do they start all over as soon as they move to Juneau County, if they move out of Milwaukee County? Is there much tracking of, my limited experience has been the three families I know, all three of them have ended up with siblings because they adopted one. Mom got pregnant again, they get approached to adopt the second, the third, and then they end up in a position where they're having to say no to number four, number five. But it continues out of state. So if there's an issue, mom's pregnant, she doesn't want to lose this baby for whatever reason, she moves to Illinois, she moves to Indiana, she moves. So do we have any national tracking of any of this, or does it stop at the county lines? Does it stop at the state lines?
We don't, we're not able to monitor that because of our Medicaid HMO status. When a family moves out of county, we have to discharge them because the Medicaid. But
DCF is coming to testify next month, so that's probably something they can answer better than.
But we do have families who move out of state. Not very often, but once in a great while.
Heather?
Are your children entered into EWSAC list, or does it depend on if they have a bureau worker also?
It's only if they have a bureau worker. Juvenile probation
system
has their own data system, and actually they're switching over to using our database right now.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you guys coming. It was very enlightening. Again, getting sands to the hourglass. Our next speaker is scheduled for 2 o'clock, and I know she had some previous engagements, so she may not be here until 2. So go ahead and take a break for 15 minutes, but then if I could have folks hover starting around like 10 to 2. 10 to 2.